Topic today is the contemporary resolution of Aguna issues, the Aguna crisis. It's something that I have a close involvement with in my capacity as the Abetin, Chief Rabbinical Judge of the Chicago Rabbinical Council, as a Chavit based in with the Beit Din of America, with my involvement regarding these issues over the past 22, 23 years or so. And it often is a controversial subject because there are many people who complain that the rabbis are not doing enough in order to resolve the Aguna crisis. So we have to discuss what exactly is the Aguna crisis and what exactly is it that the rabbis can do or can't do. And Aguna is a woman who is chained. The word Aguna comes from the word chain. It's like an anchor to a boat. That keeps the boat in place so it doesn't stray off from the shore. And so too, a woman who is an aguna is a woman who is chained in place, that she is chained to a marriage that is no longer functional. And she is no longer functional either because the husband is missing and he's presumed dead, but we can't prove for a fact that he is actually dead. So therefore, she can't move on with her life. Or it is a marriage which is simply functionally dead in the sense that the husband and wife no longer have a functional marital relationship. And the husband is refusing to give his wife a get, which she would need in order to be able to go forward with her life and to marry somebody else. So in either of these cases, a woman is referred to as an aguna. And there is a principle that the Gemara tells us in Maseches Yevamos, specifically in the context of the husband who is, say, missing at sea. He went on a boat ride and the boat sank, but nobody saw that the husband actually drowned in the water, and we can't prove conclusively that he is dead. And therefore, without evidence that her husband was seen to have perished, if it's a type of water, for example, where you can't see the boundaries of the water, it's called Mayim She'ein Lahem Sof, like an ocean, for example. And therefore, even if there were witnesses who saw the boat sink, well, one witness would be sufficient as well for these purposes. Nonetheless, if there's a possibility that the man emerged from a different place in the ocean that was beyond the point of the witness's visibility, that wouldn't be good enough either to enable a woman to remarry. But if you had Mayim She'yesh Lahem Sof, you had water which had visible and discernible boundaries, where there's even one witness who sees that a man goes into the water and then does not emerge from the water in the period of time that a person would not be able to survive, since there are discernible borders, and therefore the witness would have seen if the husband would have emerged from the water alive. So we say that this is good enough testimony to enable the woman to remarry, even though normally we require two witnesses, we require two edim in order to testify regarding a matter, especially that affects a person's personal status. Here, the rabbis were mako, they were lenient, based on halakhic considerations that isha daika minsava, that a woman is going to do her own research to make sure that she can rely upon the testimony of the one witness. And the Gemara explains that we rely upon all of these different halakhic considerations to allow one witness. In this case, it doesn't even have to be somebody who would normally be a kosher witness. And that's because Mishum Iguna Kilu Barabanan, that when it comes to the Aguna situation of ensuring that a woman whose marriage is no longer functional, either because the husband is presumed to be dead or because the marriage is dead and he's refusing to give her a get, we try to do whatever we can halachically in order to enable the woman to remarry, get on with her life. That's why many people explain that Maseches Gittin, the tractate that deals with the laws of divorce, comes right before Maseches Kiddushin, the tractate that deals with the laws of marriage. You'd figure it'd be the other way around. First, the couple gets married, and then they get divorced. The idea is, no, first the couple gets married, and they stay married. that the ideal conception of marriage in halacha is that we want a marriage to last. I may have asked him, Shana, it should go on forever. And it is very much the undesired situation that a marriage would end in divorce. But if a marriage does end in divorce, because it's not a viable marriage, so then we want the woman to be able to go on with her life and be able to get remarried immediately afterwards. That's why after Maseches Gittin comes Maseches Kiddushin. It's for the purpose of enabling there to be a functional marriage, because we want everyone to be in a functional marriage. In particular, we want to make sure, Shalot Yubinos Yisrael Agunos, that the daughters of Israel should be able to be in a functional, happy marriage. And therefore, we try everything at our disposal in order to ensure that a woman not be an aguna. There's a certain perspective that has been articulated by some that where there is a rabbinic will, there is a halachic way. That if the rabbis will there to be no agunot in the world, so we find a solution for every single aguna problem. But the reality is that everything has to be done in accordance with our adherence and our allegiance to Torah principles. We don't run the show. Sometimes there's a situation that confounds us, that is too difficult to be able to resolve according to normal principles. And the way that I like to put it is more that where there is a halachic way, there is a rabbinic will. That whenever there is a halachic way to potentially resolve aguna problems, potentially we get to resolve aguna issues, then there is and there must be a rabbinic will to be able to utilize those halachic principles in order to prevent a woman from being an aguna. So as I mentioned, there really are the two classical situations that are discussed. People mistakenly think that really from a standpoint of strict Jewish law, the different solutions to help out agunot were only in the type of situation I was describing of the man who's probably and the woman, I said my internet connection was unstable, so I paused for a second. So therefore, the woman would be unable to remarry, but unless we can say conclusively that the husband is dead. And we know that the husband is dead, so therefore we're going to be lenient, because there's nothing really to worry about. We're not dealing with an Eishes Ish. We're not dealing with a married woman, as long as we have sufficient, you know, evidence that we can be comfortable that the husband is no longer alive. This was the type of situation that we dealt with, for example, in the context of the World Trade Center tragedy in 2001, where there was a terrorist attack, as we know, upon the two twin towers. They came tumbling down. Close to 3,000 people were killed, but many of them were incinerated or pulverized so that we weren't able to identify their remains. And the halacha then had to utilize all of the different discussions that appear in the Gemara about relying upon evidence, relying upon a single witness, that places a person in a location where they couldn't possibly have survived. The question as to whether, if we spoke to a witness who spoke to a man who was presumed to have died in the World Trade Center tragedy, spoke to him after the building was hit by the plane, and the man worked, say, for the firm of Cantor Fitzgerald, which was above the 100th floor of the North Tower of the World Trade Center, where it was impossible for anybody who was there at the time that the towers were attacked by the planes to have survived, because the plane that hit the North Tower effectively severed any connection between the upper part of the building above the 92nd floor or so where the plane hit the tower and anything below the 92nd floor. So if we knew that a person was above the 92nd floor, they could not possibly have survived. It's like the Demaris case that discusses a witness who sees a person fall into a deep fiery furnace, a kivshon ha'esh, where the person cannot possibly have emerged from the fiery furnace without having been burned alive. And therefore, we know that the individual, unfortunately and tragically, was killed by virtue of the fact they fell into the fiery furnace. So we utilize those types of precedents and sources be able to permit the women to remarry if we had a witness who testified that he spoke to the husband who worked St. Cantor Fitzgerald after the tower was hit, and the conversation went something like this. Yes, I'm sitting in my office and we're trying to figure out what to do. We heard that there was a plane that hit the tower and we're trying to figure out how to get out. So then we know that the husband self-identified himself as being in a location where we found out afterwards that there was no way in the world that he could have survived. So that was something that we were able to rely upon based on the precedential discussions that appeared in the Gemara. Similarly, the Gemara speaks about simonim. If you have a person who cannot be identified in terms of their physical body, because the body has been unfortunately decomposed beyond recognition. But you see that there are certain identification marks that are on the individual where if where there are identification marks, you know that a person had a very weirdly shaped nose, that less than 1 in 1,000 people would have such a weirdly shaped nose. So can you rely upon that type of identification mark in order to say this is the person that is missing and therefore we can positively identify their remains so that the wife can remarry? And the poskim distinguish between different types of identification marks. They say that there are poor types of identification marks, like, for example, if a person was tall or short, well, lots of people are tall or short. There are intermediate types of identification marks, like, for example, that the person had a scar on their cheek. Well, okay, that's not something that everybody has. It's unusual, but probably more than 1 in 1,000 people, you know, might have a scar or a beauty mark or something of that sort. So therefore, you can rely upon that when it comes to returning a lost object. If somebody says, oh, yeah, I'm missing a wallet, and the wallet has like a green dot on the left side. Okay, so there probably are a bunch of wallets that have, you know, little dots on them, but an intermediate sign is good enough for returning a lost object, but it's not good enough for permitting a woman to remarry. But then there are the ironclad identification marks that less than 1 in 1,000 people would have. And it has to be more than, you know, a better probability than 1 in 1,000 people when there are 3,000 people who are missing. But if it's something which is highly unusual that you would have, it's that according to probability, you wouldn't have more than one of the people who are missing have the same identification mark. So then you would be allowed to rely upon such an identification mark. It's called the Simen Muvok for purposes of enabling a woman to remarry. And we had the very extensive discussion at the time of the World Trade Center tragedy about what about if a person is only identified through DNA identification. The post can speak about a fingerprint identification where it's also less than 1 in 1,000 people share the same fingerprint, so that they say you can rely upon. But a fingerprint, at least you could see a person's finger. But DNA identification, you have to go through some sort of a chemical analysis of extracting a cell and extracting a certain coding that exists within a person's cell to compare it to the same coding that you find in the person's shaver or a toothbrush or hair brush and so forth. So is that considered to be an ironclad form of identification, even though it's not visible to the naked eye? So I sat with a bunch of rabbis in the basement of Congregation Aderet El, which is the congregation that's located near the New York City Medical Examiner's Office, where they were analyzing and examining all the remains at the time of 9/11. Not that far from Stern College. There were Stern College women at the time who were renowned for serving, for doing shmira over the body parts that were being stored in the medical examiner's office at the time. And they sent over to us an expert. I think his name was Dr. Howard Baum, who was one of the world's foremost experts when it came to DNA identification, to explain this to all of the rabbis, so we can figure out whether it's a form of identification we'd be comfortable with. And we send people to the medical examiner's office who understood what they were looking at, to look at the files and the manner in which the remains were being scrutinized and analyzed and investigated, so we could be comfortable that the samples weren't being mixed up with each other. and so forth. And in the end, many of our contemporary poskim, including Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz, including the late Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, felt that DNA identification, which has a margin of error of less than 1 in 1 trillion in most cases, certainly can be considered to be a siman mavuk. What about the fact that it's not, you know, physically visible, you know, to the naked eye? So Zalman Nechemya Goldberg pointed out that there are two ways in which you can identify somebody physically. One is that you know that the person had some very unusual simanim, unusual identification marks, the person's, you look at a person's dental records and nobody has teeth that are quite the same way. So that's one way you can identify a person, which is something which is visible. You look at the teeth and you see that they match the teeth that are on the x-ray. But there's another way that you can identify somebody, and that's called tvias ayin. This is the way we generally identify each other. We don't know when we look at each other. We don't say, oh, this is my good friend, because I know that their mouth is about 2.5 inches from their nose. And I know that their eyes are about 3 inches away from each other. And I know that their face is about the following circumference. And I measure it and I say, oh, okay, fine. Now I know it's my good friend. That's not how we do it. It's not because of the fact that we are measuring a particular identification mark. It's based on tfias ayin, that you look at the totality of the individual and you just recognize through the familiarity that no two people have exactly the same face no two people have exactly the same features. And you're able to look at the peculiarity of this individual, just the total picture. It's not because of a precise measurement of an identification mark. And that's considered to be an even better identification. The Gemara in Hulin and Daf Tzadi Vav says, if witnesses come along and they give simonim, they give identification marks for a murderer, and somebody meets those identification marks, we don't put them to death. But witnesses look at a lineup and they point to a person and say, oh yeah, we know that's the murderer that we saw murdering a particular person. So then we put the person to death. The tfias ayin is considered to be more compelling. So as Zalman Nechemya Goldberg said, that this is like a tvias ayin, it's like a scientific tvias ayin, that we know that no two people share the same DNA unless they're identical twins. And therefore, if we're able to find that the DNA that is extracted from body parts, from body tissue and bones that unfortunately were at the scene of ground zero at the World Trade Center, where based on, you know, the body parts that are found, we know that whoever these body parts belong to, the rest of the body didn't survive. And they match up with the person's DNA that we have from other sources. So then that counts, as said Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg. Rabbi J. David Bleich just wrote similarly in a series of articles that he published in Tradition magazine, that would count as a tvias ayin. It would count as identification, because you know you're able to identify the uniqueness of this individual, because nobody else has the same unique features in terms of the nucleotides, in terms of the DNA coding that you extract from the individual cells. So therefore, we were able to be lenient on that basis. Now, what happens that the main tshuva, the main responsum that was written at the time by Rav Shmuel Vosner, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, was a great posek who lived in B'nai Brak, was that the DNA can only be relied upon for identifying a man who died to enable the wife to remarry if there's other circumstantial evidence as well. It can't be relied upon, but you need at least a little bit of other circumstantial evidence. So in all of our cases, we had other circumstantial evidence, because we always had people who were able to place the individual who was missing. We dealt with maybe a dozen cases, but there was always testimony that there were people who spoke to the individuals, who saw the individuals before they left the building, if they got out before the building was hit by the plane that day, but that they knew that the individuals were working at their desks in the World Trade Center in a place where most of the people got killed. We couldn't always rely on that testimony alone if it wasn't that the person was spoken to after the plane hit the North Tower and they worked in Cantor Fitzgerald. For example, if the person was spoken to before the plane hit the building, or after the plane hit the building, for example, of the North Tower, and somebody spoke to somebody in the South Tower, but it was before the South Tower was hit altogether, so they still could have conceivably gotten out of the building after the conversation, but that provided at least what we call circumstantial evidence, a probability that if the person wasn't heard from afterwards, that they were killed the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center. So if we then discovered the DNA remains, we would be able to be lenient. Similarly, there was a case where they only found some body parts of a leg that were inside a pair of pants, but inside the pair of pants, there was a wallet. And the wallet had the person's driver's license, and the wallet had the person's credit cards, and in the pants as well was the person's keys to their house and other types of objects that are not normally loaned out. That's what we call kelim de lo mushli inshi. The Gemara in Yevamos refers to that as utensils that are not normally loaned out. So are those considered to be ironclad identification marks? Or do you have to worry that maybe in an unusual circumstance, the person happened to loan out their keys? They happened to loan out their wallet with their driver's license. So there are a number of poskim who are cited in the Otzer HaPoskim to Eben HaEzer Siman Yud Zayin, who say that when you have a combination of many such identification marks or many such items, I should say, that are not normally loaned out. It's not just one. It's not just a driver's license, but it's a driver's license with all the credit cards, and it's the person's keys. I think in this case, the person's wedding ring as well, that when you have a bunch of these types of items all together, then we follow the assumption that a person wouldn't loan out all of these items at once. And therefore, we can assume that the pants and the body parts inside belong to the individual who was identified. And therefore, we were able to rely upon that as well in terms of permitting a woman to remarry in the aftermath of the World Trade Center tragedy. There was one case where there was no DNA identification. And there was no conversation that anybody had with the person in the building. And therefore, we were kind of stuck because the best that we had was the knowledge that the person left for work that morning. There are tshuvos that say that if we know a person was going in a particular direction, they would have been at a bridge, for example, at a certain time and the bridge collapsed. We can assume they were on the bridge and that they died. So questionable how much you can, you know, rely upon that, because maybe the person intended to go in that direction, but then they went in a different direction. So in this particular case, we had the person's Metro card because the person had purchased their Metro card with their credit card. They were very meticulous about record keeping. So when I used to buy Metro cards, I sometimes would buy with cash, but fortunately this person bought with their credit card. So therefore we were able to track through the Manhattan Transit Authority every single time the Metro card was used every single day, and the person always went through the 42nd Street Port Authority station at a particular time, arrived at their office in the World Trade Center at a particular time, and we saw what time on September 11th they went through the turnstiles with their Metro card on the 42nd Street station. We didn't have the record of what time they entered into the World Trade Center building because there was some type of swipe card that was used at that time, but the records for September had been destroyed when the towers came falling down. But we did have the records for the month of August. So we were able to make an algebraic equation. How long did it typically take every single day to get from the 42nd Street station to the doors of the World Trade Center? And even according to the day that the days that took the longest, this person would have been at their desk. We interviewed people. How long did it take to get up the elevator to the express elevator, to the 78th floor, the local elevators to get to the office. And even according to the latest time the person would have been presumed to have arrived, it would have been a couple of minutes before the building was hit. And this person worked not in Cantor Fitzgerald, but in the firm that was directly underneath Cantor Fitzgerald, which was also above the point where the North Tower was hit. So therefore, that was enough, according to many authorities, to establish a presumption of death. And then after we were able to establish that analysis, certainly at the very least, providing for compelling circumstantial evidence, they also did make a DNA identification on that body. It was only one remaining case where there was never a DNA identification. The person worked for the South Tower. People saw him in the South Tower, but he was in the South Tower. He was on the 87th floor. of the South Tower. The South Tower was hidden in the 78th floor. People saw him standing at the elevator bank of the 78th floor, which is where the express elevators were, shortly before the building was hit. But he didn't get in the elevator because one of the eyewitnesses said that they saw this person talking to a Port Authority officer, and the Port Authority officer was telling this individual, "We don't know if it's safer to go outside, better to just go back to your office." Nobody really knew what was safer at that point in time. Unfortunately, that turned out not to be good advice, because then the South Tower got hit, you know, immediately afterwards, and it got hit actually right at the point of the 78th floor. So if the person was still standing there, he would have been right in the line of the collision of the plane. But I guess not surprisingly, no remains were ever found for this individual, not even through DNA identification. But the way in which the planes hit the 78th floor, there was still one passageway, one staircase that was hit in a zigzag fashion. So there was one staircase where you still could have gone down. So anybody wasn't killed upon the impact. There were 10 to 12 people who were known to have walked down the stairs. They were sent to, the stairs were very smoky at that point in time. When they got to the bottom of the stairs, they were sent to a triage station where they ended up going to hospitals. This person wasn't registered as going to the hospital. So I felt you had sort of a double role, a double probability to rely upon. One, most of the people who were still in the building at that time were killed, and number who were, you know, in a certain point in the building didn't survive, and that person was part of that majority. And number two, of those who were able to get down the stairs, they all ended up going to the hospital, and this person wasn't registered as being in the hospital. So in all probability, had he survived, he would have ended up in the hospital. But not, I wasn't prosecuting the cases by myself. We, you know, shipped this out to of Gedaya Dov Schwartz, to Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, to, you know, other poskim to issue their opinions with respect to this matter. Rabbi Willig was very involved as well with corresponded with Zalman Nechemya Goldberg at the time. And Zalman Nechemya and Rabbi Schwartz both felt that there was sufficient evidence to be lenient in this case as well, even without further identification. But they wanted a third, you know, great, veteran posek as well, to rule leniently. And eventually, Ramnutta Greenblatt from Memphis, Tennessee, after 2 years had elapsed, said we can also rely upon the opinion of Rabbi Eliezer Mivordon. Rabbi Eliezer Mivordon held that when the Gemara says that if you have water with non-visible boundaries, Mayim She'ein Lahem himself, that only establishes the probability that the man died, but not a near certainty, because maybe he emerged some further point away where the witnesses are not able to see. So he says, the Gemara says that the woman is Asur Li Nasi, she's not allowed to get married. But it doesn't say Asur Li Nasi Li Olam, doesn't say she can't get married ever. So he argued that after a certain passage of time has elapsed, the neva zichro, that the memory of the man is no longer around and nobody has seen or heard from him. So then you can use that as well as a consideration that he probably died. And later poskim say that even though not everyone wanted to rely on that tremendous chiddush of Rabbi Eliezer Mivordon, then in later generations, when there are so many sophisticated means of communicating all over the world with telegrams and telegraphs, and nowadays emails and the faxes and the satellites galore, where you can at the just with a press of a button or the picking up of a telephone be able to communicate with anybody on Zoom. You could even make yourself seen to anybody all over the world. Therefore, this is a much more compelling consideration in these times. This is something that Chassam Sofer said 200 years ago. How much more so, you know, when we're dealing with the 21st century. So, Ramnutta Greenblatt said that certainly after the passage of 2 years or so, you can rely upon the passage of time. This was not a man who had any reason to escape. He got along well with his wife, thank God. No reason to run away. And therefore, you could rely upon this type of evidence. People realized that the value of the halachic process in making these determinations, because sometimes when there is a great tragedy, there's a rush to conclude that a person is dead when they're not really dead, because that's just sort of like the general assumption that so many other people have died. There was a person who worked as a vendor right outside of the World Trade Center. And he was missing after the attack. And everybody assumed he was dead. The family assumed he was dead. And there was a death certificate that was issued for him. But then it turned out 6 months later, he showed up in some hospital somewhere. Apparently, he was still alive. He walked around. He was maybe not mentally 100% well to begin with, but he was very disoriented after the attack on the World Trade Center. He ended up being sent to some type of a mental hospital, and a family member discovered him there 6 months after the attack on the World Trade Center. So you see the value of really making sure that there is sufficient evidence and not just relying on the fact that the governmental authorities found that there was a sufficient basis on their own to issue a death certificate. Now, if you have a governmental authority that issues a death certificate because they happen to see that a person died, so that's something that Chassam Sofer says you can rely upon. There's a very interesting tshuva by Rav Yitzchak Stein, who's the Carlsberger Rebbe, about this was modern day contemporary, the here and now application of, the Aguna crisis. There were, unfortunately, especially in the early months of the coronavirus, when people were dying in hospitals and family members were not even allowed to go and visit them, and they weren't able to see them at all. And you couldn't have a rabbi or a chaplain, go in and get to know the person either. There were absolutely no visitors, no witnesses when the person died. Maybe there'll be a Chevra Kedisha that dealt with the Tara, maybe not. Maybe they wouldn't even allow a Chevra Kedisha, and there would just be a funeral home that would put the person, that would bury the person in the ground. Family members were not even allowed to attend. This is even, before they figured out how to enable people to attend, through Zoom. And they would just get word that the family member died and the family member was buried. Even if there was a Chevra Kedisha, they didn't recognize the person from beforehand to know if it was the person that it was represented as being. So is this sufficient to enable the wife to remarry? So they asked apparently some posek, I don't know exactly whom, and they said, no, you have to exhume the body afterwards and do a DNA test on the body to make sure that it's really the person who died. So Rav Yitzchak Stein heard about this ruling. He said he thinks that this testimony, that there was some posek who said this, must be erroneous because he knows the posek in question. He didn't mention the name of the posek. And there's no way that anybody would rule this way because we don't exhume bodies. We don't uncover a grave. It causes, first of all, nivel ames. It's a desecration of the body, even if you don't tamper with the body too much. And chareda sedin, it causes a tremendous amount of trembling for the soul of the body. We wouldn't allow something like this if there's another way of establishing the person is dead. And he said the fact that the doctors are not allowed to issue a death certificate, if not for the fact that they can positively identify that this was the person who died, that's something that based on the Chassam Sofer, you could certainly rely upon. Also, the family member can rely upon the fact that they were called by a medical worker, a nurse, whoever it was, who said, we know your husband, your relative, and that they, and unfortunately they died. That's called, you can rely upon even the testimony of a non-Jew when it comes to testifying that a person has died. If it's Mesiach Lefitumo, they're just doing their job. They're reporting the facts. They're not telling the wife this information so she can go and remarry, so she won't be an Aguna. They're telling her this information because they're doing their job of now notifying the next of kin that the person has died. So that's also considered to be reliable. He quoted from the Imre Yosher, from Rameir Arik, who says this very, very emphatically. And thirdly, they can rely upon the ID. Every single patient has an ID band, which is placed around their wrist, and that identifies the person. And he quotes from a tshuva called the tshuva, a sefer of tshuvas called Chabetzelis HaSharon, who says this is stronger than even an ironclad identification mark, because this is not meant as an identification mark, like the way that a person's nose is shaped or the way that a person's teeth are shaped. This is specifically placed there in order to make sure that it remains on the individual at all times as a form of a constant identification of the person. It's not an identification mark. It is a form of the person's, it's an extension of the person. It's a way in which every single person, every single medical worker is able to confirm at all times, whom the patient is, so that they make sure they're operating on the right person, that they're treating the right person, and so forth. It is considered to be part and parcel of the individual himself or herself. And therefore, he says, based on all of these considerations, plus he throws in Neva Zichro, a passage of time for good measure. He says that you could certainly rely upon that in order to enable the women to remarry. So it's very fascinating. We see even during this time, who would have thought that you'd have to have an Aguna type of a response some during the coronavirus epidemic. But I just read this tshuva today, so I'm sharing it with you, hot off the press. Very, very fascinating. So this is certainly one type of case which is mentioned. We'll spend the remaining just a short period of time, 10 to 12 minutes. What about the husband who's refusing to give his wife a get? So was the Gemara really concerned about that as an Aguna situation, or is that a modern day thing that we say, okay, but we're going to try to be lenient in those cases too, but that wasn't really what the Gemara was talking about. Truth is, it's clear it was what the Gemara was talking about. The Gemara speaks about a man who's about to go off on a business trip, and he's writing a get for his wife, and we can't find witnesses to sign the get who are proficient in terms of knowing how to sign the get. So the Gemara in Gittin and Daf Yud Tes Amud Beis says, even though when it comes to other documents, we don't like carve out outlines for the witnesses just to fill their names in ink in the outlines if they don't otherwise know how to sign their name. When it comes to a get, we do that because we're afraid we're not going to be able to find other witnesses. We're not able to find other witnesses. So then it's possible the man's going to leave. He's going to disappear. And the woman's going to end up being an aguna. This is a man who is very much alive and well, but nonetheless, we're taking affirmative measures to apply leniencies in terms of who is qualified to serve as a witness for the get. Even people who don't know how to sign their names, they could just fill in the ink in order to ensure that a woman not end up being an aguna. So we really have to apply those very same leniencies. There's a line in the Tshuva's Habach, where the Bach cites the notion that anybody who resolves an aguna situation is considered as if they have rebuilt the ruins of Jerusalem. It brings us closer to the coming of Mashiach. The Maharshah seems to say something similar in his comments towards the end of Maseches Yevamos. So what we've tried to do at the Beit Din of America over the years, we do this at the Chicago Rabbinical Council as well, is to make sure that you apply the principle that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound or a ton of cure, to put mechanisms in place to ensure that a woman not be an aguna altogether. And if you have the ability to put mechanisms in place, you have a solemn obligation to do so. I've said before, I think it's rabbinic malpractice not to take advantage of halakhic mechanisms you can put into place in order to prevent a woman from being an aguna. So the one that was devised, Rabbi Willig wrote up a shtar of a halakhic prenuptial agreement. Halakhic prenuptial agreement really addresses what is one of the major problems that causes aguna situations here in America. In Europe, you had fewer aguna situations. You had, don't get me wrong, you had aguna situations. You had fewer aguna situations of recalcitrant husbands, however, because the Batei Din, the rabbinical courts in all of the different geographical areas, had jurisdiction over the husbands, and they can haul him into court. They can haul him into the rabbinical court, and they can impose sanctions upon him, which would be recognized by the government. You can't coerce a get as a general rule. You can't beat up a man, you know, until he gives a get, except for very few and far between cases that are discussed in the Gemara. I know you hear of such stories coming out of certain cities and geographical areas of rabbis who beat up husbands in order to give their wives a get. But generally speaking, that creates an invalid get. So you have a situation of a husband who's beating his wife, a husband who has a medical condition where no woman in the world would be able to live with him. He's like a mukashkin. He's filled with boils all over his body. But generally speaking, we don't have cases that warrant coercion, according to halacha. We have the shita of Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam said that if a woman says that her husband is repulsive to her, so we follow Rabbeinu Tam that we don't allow coercion in that case. The Rambam did, but we follow Rabbeinu Tam. Coercion is not allowed in that case, but you are allowed to apply distancing measures. Hachokos to Rabbeinu Tam, meaning that we're not going to invite the person to our weddings. We're not going to give the person aliyos. We're not going to give them a seat in the synagogue. We're not going to do business with the person. So all of those measures are allowed to be taken. Rav Avraham Yosef as a tshuva in which he affirms the principle that we basically follow that approach. We don't consider that to be coercive because the person, if he doesn't like it, could go somewhere else. You could usually find somewhere else to go. But if he wants to remain in good standing in this community, So then he's not going to be afforded any honors or privileges until he gives his wife a get. So we take all of those measures when it's necessary. But the easier thing is to get the man to come to court in the first place, to come in front of the Beis Din. And therefore, we have a prenuptial agreement that says that the man agrees at the time that he gets married, that if there is ever going to be any dispute with the wife wants to get, and he doesn't want to give one, he will abide by the ruling of the Beis Din. Now, in addition, the prenuptial agreement also adds a little bit of extra teeth. It says that for the entire period that he and his wife will be separated, a husband has to support his wife anyway, but we don't usually quantify the amount of support. He'll pay her a certain amount of support, which we have calibrated as corresponding to the cost of living index. Most of our from communities here in America, which is $150 a day, food, clothing, and shelter, adds up to about $54,000 a year. And he's going to pay that amount of his support as long as the couple is still married, as long as they're still married according to Jewish law. It's not described as a penalty for not giving the get. If it would be a penalty, maybe that would be punitive and that would be considered a coerced get. It's just an affirmative obligation to support his wife as long as they're still married according to Jewish law. The Piskei Tshuva and Ibn Ezra, Siman Kuf Lamed Daled, quotes the Torah as gittin, as essentially saying that this is a non-punitive, perfectly permissible measure that can be utilized in order to ensure that a get be given in a prompt and timely fashion. I've been involved in well over 100 cases over the past 20 years where, as a result of the fact that the couple signed a prenuptial agreement at the time that they got married, a get was given in a timely fashion. It's extremely important. Do not get married without one. Don't let your friends get married without one. I had I performed the wedding last night. I was Mesader Kiddushin, and the husband didn't want to sign the prenuptial agreement without permission of his Rosh Yeshiva, not a YU Rosh Yeshiva. So I spoke to the Rosh Yeshiva. The Rosh Yeshiva wasn't so keen about the halakhic prenuptial agreement. Don't know exactly why, but maybe, you know, some people are hesitant about things that weren't always done, although the form that it's based upon is a form of the Nachla Shiva from 300 years ago. Rav Zalman Nechemia approved of the prenuptial agreement. Rav Asher Weiss approves of the prenuptial agreement, but okay. Some people have reservations, so I had a conversation with Rosh Yeshiva, and we discussed a different formulation. Moshe Feinstein has a formulation of the prenuptial agreement in his Chuvos. This is in Evan Ezra Chelek Dalet Siman Kuf Zayin, where he simply asks the first part of the provision, saying that the couple agree that if there's ever going to be a dispute, they agree to submit it to a particular Beis Din. And if that Beis Din says that a get should be given, then a get should be given. So we agreed, and Rav Moshe said, put it in the Tanoim. You know, with every single chasana, you have the Tanoim and you have the Ksuva. So instead of having the Tanoim, the Ksuva in a separate standalone, a local prenuptial agreement, so Moshe says, put it in the text of the Tanoim. So we put the clause. We put the clause straight out of Rav Moshe's Tshuva in the text of the Tanoim. And this Rosh Yeshiva was satisfied, said, good, well, we could do it that way. So we made sure that the couple had a halakhic prenuptial agreement. So even if they can't necessarily agree on one form of prenuptial agreement, they can agree on a different form of halakhic prenuptial agreement. But it's very important to put this in place because my experience is the best possible seatbelt that really resolves aguna situations, making sure that the situations don't arise in the first place. We also have about 20 years ago, there were two students that came to my office, one from Yeshiva College, one from Stern College. They came to my office in the Beth in America maybe 18 years ago, something, I think it's about 20 years ago. And they said they want to do something in order to be able to help resolve the Aguna situation. What can be done? So I said, you know what? Very often we'll issue psakim, we'll issue a decision from the Beth and saying it's appropriate for a husband to give his wife a get. We can't beat him up per se, but it's appropriate to give his wife a get. And then it's up to the community to apply the measures of Rabbeinu Tam to put proper pressure on the husband until he gives his wife a get. We need an organization that's going to really take charge of putting that communal pressure when our Beis Din or a different Beis Din issues a psak saying that a husband is refusing to show up to the Beis Din altogether for an adjudication regarding the get issue. Let's say they didn't sign a prenuptial agreement and we can't force him into the Beis Din, or he's refusing to give a get when the Beis Din has ordered that it's a mitzvah, and that it's the proper thing for the husband to do to give his wife a get. So we need an organization that's really going to go out there and serve as kind of like an enforcement arm. Shoftim v'shotrim titzen lecha, an enforcement arm of the Bezin. And that's how ORO was founded. I have to say that the ORO organization for resolution of agunot, right? Ayidim Haisa ORO v'simcha, right? That the organization that really has been proactive during this period of time in terms of cooperating with the Batei Din in making sure that the psakim, that the decisions that are issued by the Beis Din after due process, you always have to have due process, that a person is not complying properly with the Beis Din, and that these psakim are then subject to community enforcement, demonstrations, and so forth. I said at the time, you need two components in order to ensure that the organization be successful and properly run. One, you need top-notch legal counsel in order to make sure that you not do things that, you know, are illegal. So I suggested Michelle Greenberg Coburn as the person that they should go to, as I think she was working at a law firm, Sidley Austin, at the time. She subsequently became a dean at Columbia University, and she agreed to serve in that capacity. And I suggested that they need a top-notch halachic posek. They need somebody who's going to guide them to make sure that the measures they take are not too strong, that everything that they're doing is within the framework of halacha based on the circumstances of the case. And I suggested Rav Herschel Schechter Shlita to serve as the halachic posek for ORO, and Rav Schechter graciously agreed. And that's the model. That's the model that they have followed up until this day. So these are measures that are appropriate for us to do. But people speak about, what about a systemic solution? A systemic solution that you shouldn't have a need for a get anymore. But the Torah says you have a need for a get. We have a need for a get because it says something about the sanctity of the Jewish marriage. The reason why we're working so hard to resolve aguna cases is because we believe in the sanctity of the Jewish marriage, that we want that after Maseches Gittin, there should be Maseches Kiddushin, that there should be a beautiful and harmonious and holy and sacred Jewish marriage. So therefore, the whole idea of the get was that something which is sacred can't be, you know, unraveled so quickly. There has to be a process. There has to be a protocol. Sefer Chinuch says that it's in part a protection for women, that a husband should not precipitously divorce his wife without a due cause. If he has a temper tantrum or something like that, he has to get a sofa, he has to get an eidim, he has to get a bezdin, he has to go through a get. So we want there to be a process. There has to be a process, but the process should not be abused. It should not be abused, and it should be understood the same way in which it's described in Parashas Ki Tetzeh, that it's a matter of fact thing. That if a marriage doesn't work out, there's no such thing as holding up a get as a weapon, as a leverage, so that the husband can get a better deal in the divorce proceedings. No such thing. It's just automatic. Marriage doesn't work out, a get should be given. And so we should always have that sensitivity. We should always have that sensibility that this is the Torah way. The Torah way is that we don't hold up a get when a marriage is no longer functioning. Try to save a marriage. The post can talk about chai chadoshim. You try to have therapy and counseling for up to 18 months. But when it's clear that a marriage is clearly over, it's over, a get should be given. Yetz Hashem, everybody here, you should all have only happy and successful marriages. So it should be a theoretical discussion for all of you. I wish you the best. Everybody should stay healthy.